From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Jose. South San Jose.
What?
That's where you're from in the Bay Area?
I'm confused.
Coming up, we look at a Bay Area organization that's focused on making sure every American kid can read.
We really feel like our work that we do in schools is so important, you know, more now than ever.
Then, from literacy to healthcare, we talk to a children's advocate who believes in the Affordable Care Act and is watching the Supreme Court.
Our healthcare system simply cannot continue to absorb people just treating symptoms and treating disease.
And we get nostalgic for a time preceding iPods and MP3s when music brought us together.
It was a bonding activity. It was a sort of shared cultural activity.
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. This week, the California Department of Education gave us some grim news. According to its biannual report on the financial health of the state's school systems, nearly one-fifth of school districts in the state face bankruptcy. And that includes 6 Bay Area districts, 4 in Santa Clara County and 2 in San Mateo County. And so, as the academic year ends, school districts around the Bay Area have the daunting and often frustrating task of forecasting the future of their school budgets for the next year. Current predictions hold that the Oakland Unified School District will need to downsize its budget by $100 million over the next 3 years. San Francisco Unified predicts a deficit of $119 million over the next 2 years if Governor Brown's tax proposals don't pass. In short, things are looking dire for students, particularly low-income children who lack the resources to seek outside help with school. Enter Reading Partners, a nonprofit organization dedicated to getting these students up to reading speed. Founded 11 years ago here in the Bay Area, it now works with more than 3,300 students nationally. KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs has the story.
Make sure the limb is strong. Now pull yourself off the ground and wait until the spring, then swing. There's an eyeball in the gumball machine. Right there between the red and the green, looking at me as to say, you don't need any more gum today.
Bungalow number 1 at Sanchez Elementary School in San Francisco's Castro District is a freestanding classroom reserved exclusively for teaching kids to read. It's a sunny, airy space with colorful boards displaying favorite books and tricky words. In the corner, a paper tree grows up towards a ceiling spangled with stars, each one labeled with the name of a student. Ann Little is the site coordinator for Reading Partners at Sanchez Elementary. She's responsible for organizing 79 students and 118 volunteers.
I work with the teachers to identify students that would be a good fit for the program.
These are kids who have fallen 6 months to 2 years behind in reading.
And I assess those students and develop an educational program for them for their reading. And then I also train the community volunteers who come into the Reading Center so that the best learning and tutoring is going on.
Registered students work with tutors twice a week in 45-minute sessions.
I have a hot dog for a pet, the only kind my folks would yet let me get. He does smell.
We work with schools who are under-resourced, who are needing that support, and with students who are reading behind grade level.
Lindsay Kessel manages the Reading Partners program in San Francisco. It's one of many programs aimed at increasing literacy, including 826 Valencia and the Mission Learning Center. Kessel says when Reading Partners decides to work with a school, they take a lot of factors into consideration, like how easy it will be to recruit volunteers in that area, or how many students are in need of reading assistance.
We target schools who fit that profile and we take over a classroom, we create a reading center, and we bring in volunteers. So that means for every volunteer we have, we can enroll another student in the program.
Kessel says just 26 total hours of tutoring generally means one whole grade level improvement for a student. That's critical when standardized testing shows nearly half of California students don't show proficiency in language arts.
I really think what makes Reading Partners so successful is the one-on-one format. Every volunteer is paired with a student, and they get to work with that student for the semester or ideally the entire year, and they get to see the progress that student makes.
You're working with one student, mm-hmm. so you really get to know that student, and you get to sort of follow them for the whole year.
Barb Shipley is one of the volunteers at Sanchez Elementary.
So over the 4 years that I've been here, I've worked with a different student each school year. It's just really rewarding to see your student go from, you know, when that little part clicks that gets them to become a better reader. It's really fun to see.
And if it's fun for the tutor, chances are the students will be more engaged.
When students feel comfortable with their tutor and have built that relationship, they are able to take more learning risks, and with more learning risks, they have more progress and improvement.
Reading Partners uses a detailed curriculum developed by faculty and grad students at the Stanford School of Education. Barb Shipley primarily works with beginning readers on phonology.
Where you're working on a different sound each day. So it starts out with just consonant sounds, and now Carla's sort of at the end of that curriculum. And today we worked on the oi sound, like you would hear in boy or soil.
And the red sauce had one. But the big story was John McNabb.
Schools pick up about a quarter of their own costs. Foundations help too. Since 2007, Reading Partners has been supported by Tipping Point Community, which funds groups fighting poverty in the Bay Area. Last year, Tipping Point provided $500,000.
I think they've really figured out how to work with volunteers in a way that many nonprofit groups have not.
Daniel Lurie is Tipping Point's founder and CEO.
They make the experience extraordinarily meaningful. They use the volunteers' times very efficiently and effectively, and they're very focused.
At this point, Reading Partners has over 4,000 volunteers nationally and continues to expand. For every school the program works with, there are about two more on the wait list.
Literacy is the foundation for all children and their learning and what we can expect from them in the future. And if they're falling three grade levels behind by the time they're 9 years old, we're all going to have the repercussions of that.
It could be argued that California is already feeling the repercussions. The state spends $15.3 billion on educating its residents and $15.4 billion incarcerating them. Investing a little more on the early side can make a difference for a child and the society that child will grow into.
He does smell sort of bad, and yet he absolutely never gets the sofa wet.
In San Francisco, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs for Cross Currents.
The strangest vet you ever met. Guess we're the weirdest family yet to have a hot dog for a pet.
You can see which Bay Area schools are partnering with Reading Partners at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Societies around the world recognize child literacy and elementary education as a human right. It's actually guaranteed by the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And Article 24 of that convention also guarantees this.
State parties recognize the right of the child to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of health and to facilities for the treatment of illness and rehabilitation of health. State parties shall strive to ensure that no child is deprived of his or her right of access to such health care services.
When the Federal Affordable Care Act went into effect 2 years ago, champions of child health care cheered. More children would be covered by their parents' health insurance, pre-existing conditions would be thrown out of the equation, among other issues child advocates had been fighting for. But almost immediately after its enactment, this happened.
The challenge to the president's health care law officially reaches the highest court in the land. A petition filed yesterday asking the Supreme Court justices to take up the case. And this follows last month's split appeals court decision upholding the insurance requirement. And this sets the stage for a possible election year showdown over the president's signature initiative.
The ACA came under fire from Republicans nationwide, and 26 states filed suit against the government, claiming the law was unconstitutional because it mandates insurance coverage. While the Supreme Court decides whether or not the law will stand, child health care advocates await that decision intently. One of them is Jamila Iris Edwards, Northern California director for the Children's Defense Fund. She came by KALW Studios, and I asked her what would happen if the ACA is struck down.
We just recently had a meeting. We have regular calls. We had a meeting where that someone raised that issue. And, you know, like, even though our state has said we're going to keep doing it regardless of what happens, we're like already, you know, have the systems in place and everything's already started. You know, we're thinking to ourselves, all these laws that we've passed on health reform, you know, some of them might say, and we don't know for certain which we do, some of them might say, depending on, you know, what goes on in the federal government, XYZ will go on in California. So now we're trying to think back and wonder, like, okay, what actual pieces will be in place? What will require new legislation? How does the changes in our legislature, the fact that we're changing our primary processes and we're going to have new folks in the legislature after June and people worrying about campaigning, like how will that affect how California's been so supportive of health care reform, but how will what happens with the Supreme Court and whether or not we have to redo things? What's that going to look like? It's very, very scary, very daunting. And, you know, we're trying to put positive energy out there and really recognize that even though there's a lot to worry about and it may not work if the individual mandate, because that's the big issue with the Supreme Court is this individual mandate.
Right.
We don't know quite yet what's going to happen. But the thing that we're really hopeful about is that our state's administrative officials have said that they're going to keep going. And so that's kind of what we're holding on to. And it's business as usual because technically it's still law. And we're hoping that'll continue.
Right. And so part of that positive energy, let's go on along those lines and talk about to what extent have children in California benefited from the Affordable Care Act so far within the last 2 years?
It's been great. I would say I think of it in two buckets. There's prevention and then there's protection. And if there's one thing that, you know, we could take away from today, it's that our healthcare system simply cannot continue to absorb people just treating symptoms and treating disease. And the Affordable Care Act recognizes that and has huge investments in prevention for children especially. So there's investments in the prevention on kind of the primary, there's the primary care side, so giving people access to more primary care options. For children, that means no co-payments for preventive services, immunizations, well baby checkups, those necessary things for primary care. But also healthcare reform invests a lot of money in primary prevention. So there's what's called community transformation grants. So there's these investments for community-based organizations, for public health agencies, for providers to do things in their community so that people don't get sick.
Like what? Are we talking about mainly nutrition and exercise campaigns?
That's one way. There's a variety of things that can fund community transformation grants can fund a variety of things. So yeah, so examples would be like things that would kind of anti-obesity efforts, healthy making your community more walkable, increasing access to healthy foods, whatever the organizations can do to really improve the conditions in their community. That's what the Affordable Care invests in. There's also the fact that kids can stay on, young people can stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26.
Which is a point of contention as well.
Yeah, exactly.
If they're staying until 26 years old, that's an extra cost.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why we have to have equal and in some ways, I think more sometimes investment into prevention, because we just can't absorb all the new people without trying to stop them from having to come into the system as it is. Once you get diabetes, you have diabetes for the rest of your life. You know, you can't cure that. So there's that. There's investments in even going back early childhood and infant care and really kind of connecting providers with those communities that are at risk. There's strong investments in school-based health centers, which is something that we see here in the Bay Area a lot, especially in Oakland. There's this proliferation of school-based health centers because really the idea is to bring care to where the kids are. So that's happening. These are all things that are happening now. And then there are protection sides. They're the fact that now you can't deny children insurance because they have a pre-existing condition. You can't drop someone from their health insurance because they get sick. You can't impose lifetime kind of dollar limitations on children's health care. This is all things that are happening now, that there's a variety of stories out there about how children are benefiting now from health reform.
And so as the Supreme Court makes its decision, if things are, the ball is already rolling pretty much in California, it sounds like it'll be pretty hard to just stop it from rolling. If somebody's in the middle of a program funded by the ACA,
right, exactly,
you know, and they're doing well, what would happen to me if this law is struck down?
Right.
So those are the kind of decisions that you need to make. What do we keep? What do we, you know, how do we change the law? How do we not change the law, but kind of make our own provisions locally?
Exactly, exactly. And the question is, you know, what is the state going to do? Is the state going to do its own individual mandate? You know, if you think of like San Francisco, for example, you know, has its own health system and their own universal health care. So there's an example of a city that, you know, regardless, is going to go on ahead with, you know, continuing to provide health care to all. We're hoping that stays in California. But again, there's so many different moving targets. There's elections coming up. There's this ongoing budget battle that we have. There's whether or not kind of the governor's propositions will pass. There's a lot of things that, you know, we as kind of a coalition without working with these other groups really kind of have to keep our eye on as we're waiting for the Supreme Court's decision, because we don't know, you know, what will happen. We know that it looks like folks, our leaders here are still interested in being the lead car. So we're hoping that continues.
Jamila Iris Edwards is the Northern California Director of the Children's Defense Fund. And we'd like to hear your take on the Affordable Care Act. Call us and leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You can also post on our Facebook page, KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now for some artery, cultural coverage that evolves with the times. As the nation ponders the question of what our health care should look like, one thing most people would agree on is the healing power of music. A soft classical piece can soothe headache or just lower your level of stress. A powerful reggaeton beat can get you moving and exercising your muscles. And if you're like me, then your phone is full of the music you love to lace up and hit the trails with. Here's a quick sampling of my workout music. Shake it like a Polaroid picture. Whatever makes you groove, one thing is certain. The changing manner in which we listen to songs has today's music industry in upheaval, and not for the first time. For over a century, the dominant method of distributing popular music was on printed sheets of paper, sheet music. Sheet music had a long run from the mid-1800s into the 1930s. And while most of the printed songs from that time are now forgotten, their graphically striking cover illustrations provide a reminder of what we've lost in the digital age. Numerous historical examples are currently on display at the Society of California Pioneers. KALW's Stephen Short joined exhibition curator James Keller at the Society's headquarters in San Francisco to talk about how the shift from music on paper to music on recordings changed more than an industry. It also transformed family social time.
The corner of 4th and Folsom in San Francisco is a busy 21st century intersection. On one corner there's a gas station, on the other is the Yerba Buena complex, then there's a multi-story office building, and on the fourth corner is the Society of California Pioneers. Go through that door and you go back in time. What we're hearing is obviously an early recording from nearly a century ago.
But most of the music here is from the pre-recorded era. It would only have been performed, it couldn't have been heard on recordings, and so therefore it would have been performed at home.
James Keller is talking about the Society's current exhibit, Singing the Golden State. About half of the material in this exhibit of sheet music, which Keller curated, is from his voluminous personal collection.
He had considered mounting a show of his own.
But then as we began talking further, it came to light that the Society of California Pioneers itself has a superlative collection of sheet music. It's called the Frederick Sherman Music Collection that was donated to the Society back in the 1940s.
That's Sherman as in Sherman Clay and Company. They would have a great collection of sheet music because they built home pianos. Still do, actually. Today, many homes have entire rooms dedicated to multimedia entertainment. But prior to the 1930s, our options for musical performances outside of church were rare. You might say that musical entertainment had to be locally sourced.
Consumers were the people who were making their own music. And in those days, before the gramophone was available, the parlor piano was really the entertainment center of the home. Every home aspired to have one. And the high point of entertainment would be gathering around the parlor piano and singing. So that's what people did.
Oh, you old Pacific coast, oh, you land I love the most.
And it was a real experience of bonding. It was a sort of shared cultural activity that people maybe don't have quite so often today. I think there's an important glue in society. People viewed music as something essential in drawing them together with other people.
I was surprised to find out that sheet music was regularly included in newspapers. Can you explain that? I mean, I can't imagine how the sheet music publishers would think this was a good idea. Giving away the store, you know?
Well, yes, it was often included in Sunday newspapers. It was a special supplement printed in color. So it was very much analogous to the funny papers that we all know in newspapers even to this day. But it was good publicity. It was good publicity for a publisher, for a composer, for a lyricist, or for a star, because often these pieces would have a picture of a vaudeville star, a theater star on the cover.
I guess you could compare it to a free computer download today.
Very much, very much. You know, it's just a change of form over the years. It's not a change of idea, ultimately.
Keller says the topics of these songs were both more diverse and more personal than what we have today.
This is music from a time when people really felt that their hometown was a place that they wanted to sing about and that it deserved it.
In a Pasadena town.
I really respect that, and I've grown to really love it. I think that music can bring alive the spirit of an era in a really unusual way.
Most of the early songs we've sampled here are available at listening stations in the exhibit, and most of the scratches have been removed, making it easier for modern ears to hear, as well as see, the music that gave spirit to another era. In San Francisco, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
So get up and dance to a song that was a hit before your mother was born. Though she was born a long, long time ago, your mother should know.
Singing the Golden Gate, celebrating the history of California through sheet music, is on display at the Society of California Pioneers in San Francisco until December 7th. All the information is at klw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jordan Katz, RTM's Konohovs, Erica Moo, Lisa Ratner, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share. They provide an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio.
Shake it like a Polaroid picture.
Tune in to Cross Currents Monday at 5 for a special edition on how refugees are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sometimes I feel like everything's like for me after Iraq is different, even like the roads, the air, the dust.
I know back home, the dust of back home. I know the air of back home.
That's Monday at 5 on Cross Currents. The music you're hearing is being played by Robert Howard. He's playing a Chopin selection here, but will perform Benjamin Britten's Suite No. 1 for unaccompanied cello next Tuesday. His performance is part of the Noontime Music Series at Old St. Mary's Church on California Street in San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.